Marty Lilstein here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. On this episode of Celeb Savant, I will be speaking to Jack Hughes from Wang Chung. Wang Chung are an English new wave band formed in London in 1980 by Nick Feldman, Jack Hughes, and Darren Costin. The name Wang Chung means yellow bell in Chinese and is the first note in the Chinese classical musical scale. The band found their greatest success in the USA with 5 top 40 hits there, all charting between 1983 and 1987, including Dancehall Days, Everyone Have Fun Tonight, and Let's Go. This is Celeb Savant, Barrett Edelstein, speaking to Jack Hughes from Wang Chung. This is Barrett Edelstein, Celeb Savant, and today we are speaking to Mr. Jack Hughes from Wang Chung. Jack, where do we find you in the world? What's happening in your life? And how are you today?
Well, I'm good. To answer your questions in reverse order, I'm in Canterbury, which is in the UK, about 60 miles southeast of London, and I'm actually working on some Wang Chung tracks. We're planning on releasing, it's the 40th anniversary of our very first album, which came out in 1982, called Wang Chung, when we spelt the name a little differently, H-U-A-N-G instead of W-A-N-G. And we found some extra tracks on the multi-tracks from the studio sessions, you know. So I've just been mixing those and so that we can put them on the CDs. It's initially going to be a sort of deluxe edition CD release, and we'll eventually get round to releasing it on vinyl as well, but that takes a little more time these days, you know. There's a lot of material shortages and so on, you know. So anyway, that's what you find me doing, working on Wang Chung stuff.
Let's take it to the very beginning. Tell me how you guys started, how you guys chose the name. Let's go to day one of Wang Chung.
Wang Chung. Well, I met Nick in, well, way back, I think it was really 1978 that I met Nick, so that's really a long time ago. And I met him through doing an audition for his band, as he had it then. His band was called The Intellectuals. And I got the gig as his sort of backup guitar player. Nick and I then went through various incarnations of bands. We picked up various players along the way. We had Glenn Gregory, who went on to join Heaven 17. We had Lee Gorman, who went on to join Bow Wow Wow, working in our bands. But eventually we distilled it down to me, Nick, Darren Costin, and Dave Bernand as the sort of Wang Chung, as we called it. And we managed to get a record deal with a little independent label. This was in the days of sort of punk in London, and there were lots of indie labels, and one of them signed us up to release a couple of singles. And that's really what set Wang Chung on its way.
Tell us more about the name. Why you guys chose the name?
Yeah, it's always difficult to answer that question, you know, because it's a very whimsical thing, you know. When you, I don't know if you've ever been in a band and sat around and try and decide a name, you know, you put things in a hat almost. And but Wang Chung, I guess, was just really unusual. There were a few bands around at the time with Chinese. There was China Crisis, you know. Susie and the Banshees were doing a slightly kind of Chinese thing. There was a band called Japan as well. So I think Orientalism was in the air. But we chose it in a slightly jokey way, really, you know, that it was partly to do with the sound of it. I thought it sounded like, you know, a guitar. But the name actually means yellow bell in Chinese, Wang, yellow, Chung, Jong, bell. And it's this yellow bell that rings at the center of the universe and produces like billions of frequencies. But our reality is one of those frequencies. So I thought that was a pretty good idea, you know.
That is a cool idea, because then you creating music and sound on one of those frequencies for everyone to listen to.
Yeah, and it's harmonizing with that frequency. The idea is, you know, that music should be in tune with the with a Wang Chung.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, that's a cool idea, you know. But obviously, it was quite to begin with. We found it quite an alienating name, you know, because people. It's got no. I mean, one of the things I liked about it was that it's quite a like anti-rock and roll name, if you like, you know. And obviously people could have no connection with the name, which, again, I liked, you know. But when we signed to Geffen Records, David Geffen said, because we were thinking about changing the name completely, and he said, no, you should keep the name because it's catchy, but change the spelling so that people can just say it and not feel alienated by it. So that's how he got it to Wang Chan.
Now tell us about your music creativity process. Back in the day in the 80s, and currently you said you're releasing, going to be releasing a 40th anniversary with some potentially some new songs, which we're excited to hear about. Tell us about how you create music, what inspires you, and your journey of creating nothing from that sound frequency to a beautiful song at the end of that 3-minute cycle.
Yeah, how can I answer that sort of sensibly, meaningfully? You know, it's a strange process. It's quite intuitive for me, quite unconscious a lot of the time. I guess back in the 80s when I was writing, I don't think it's any different now. You know, I'll be noodling around on a guitar or a keyboard and come up with some sort of combination, quite often with chords or something like that, or some sort of texture, which generates a sort of bit of an emotion. And out of that emotion, I try and write a lyric and stuff. And the best songs I find, I write the lyrics and the music pretty quickly together, you know. But it usually starts from a little idea that you then kind of explode out into a sort of bigger structure. And obviously songs, especially in the 80s, were highly structured. You know, you had your intro, verse, chorus sort of thing, you know. Although I always try to play around with that, you know. So like Dance All Days, for example, doesn't really have a chorus, if you know what I mean. There's the sax riff, I suppose, and I sing Dance All Days over that, but again, that's more of a link back to the verse. So I try to always keep things very fluid, you know. My sort of songwriting heroes are the Beatles, really, or John Lennon and Paul McCartney, you know, and the way that they were able to create songs that didn't get bogged down in a big chorus, you know, but that would be quite flexible. I used to teach songwriting at the university here in Canterbury, and I used to spend quite a lot of time talking about form and structure, and that to me is pretty key, and being able to manipulate all that is important, I think.
It's amazing. So many of the artists I've spoken to, many of them, I've mentioned some of your friends, Chesney and Carol Decker and China Crisis I've spoken to, and so many of them have mentioned the Beatles, and it's amazing how they created a foundation for so many artists to develop out of, and inspired so many artists to create, and for us to, as listeners, to enjoy through the 70s, 80s, even present day. So we thank the Beatles for being around, because
if they, well, I think, you know, I still think their legacy, you know, I mean, obviously it's fine to just play Beatles records like Beatles records, you know, but I don't think they're still not truly appreciated for what they really did to pop music, you know. I mean, I think Pete Townsend said, you know, they changed pop music into art music, sort of, or put the art into pop music. Well, they certainly did that, you know. But they did something else as well, something very profound, I think. And if you were growing up with them, as I was, I mean, I was 8 years old when I first heard the Beatles, you know, but between when I was 8 to when I was 12 was when they released From Please Please Me to Sgt. Pepper, you know. And that was an incredible music education. And also they were culturally really significant, especially in the UK. They were right there on the news, sort of. They weren't just like a band. It's very hard to conceive it these days, you know, because a band would not generate like a prime bit of evening news, but they would, you know. So they were very important culturally. You know.
Are you still teaching music writing?
No, I don't do that anymore. No, I did that for about 10 years in all, I suppose, starting off just like doing an hour a week to help a friend out, sort of thing, and ending up teaching a full 3-year sort of degree course for students. Yeah, I stopped doing it for sort of personal reasons mainly, but I also did feel, I don't know, to begin with, the students, maybe they were growing up with the sort of legacy of 90s guitar bands who in turn were very influenced by the Beatles. So I could talk about the Beatles and Dylan and Hendrix and the Stones and those artists that have really influenced me. And it all made sense to those kids in the early 2000s, you know. But as time wore on, guitar bands became less and less relevant in a sense, and dance music really took on more. And also maybe the attitude of the students changed a bit as well, from being open to suggestions to being a little more kind of, well, I kind of like it how it is, thanks. I don't need your advice, you know.
Oh, wow.
Which isn't fair enough in a way. But yeah, and also I think when you're teaching, you know, you need to refresh, you know. So I sometimes do like a day or like a sort of master class type thing at the university here. But I decided to to drop the sort of class teaching, as it were. I just felt that I wasn't fresh and wasn't really helping the students, you know. So, yeah.
I want to dive into a couple of your bigger songs, Dancehall Days and Everyone Have Fun Tonight. Let's dive deep into those couple of songs. Tell us a little bit about them, what inspired them, and why we love them so much. And what about them do you love about so much?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you all love them. You know, that's good for me. Dancehall Days, I've said many times, I was, you know, this was in the sort of early days of Wang Chung, in a sense. We did an album with Arista, this one that I was talking about, Wang Chung, which we're going to re-release. That was, it didn't have the sort of massive hit single that they hoped it would be, or the record company didn't manage to create it as a hit single. And so we were, you know, how can I put it? As a writer, you feel the pressure, in a sense, of like, you know, you've got to come up with something that's going to connect with people, you know. And I came up with Dancehall Days when I was still teaching guitar at that point just in secondary schools here in the UK, you know, or in London, actually. And some kid didn't show up for their lesson, and I was just messing around and came up with the main chords of Dancehall Days and the main lyric as well, the take your baby by the hand thing, you know. But I think it's probably the rhythm that was the catchy thing about it. And in those days, you know, drum machines were new and everyone was using them, and drum machines were very much about 4/4 and going boom boom ding 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 ding. They could do that very well because they divide the beats up into, you know, everything's divided by two. But if you start dividing everything by three, drum machines get confused.
Yeah.
And so it became quite a challenge to try and get the feel, the sort of the kind of electronic feel that I wanted, you know, but also this kind of shuffle rhythm to it, which we took in a way from the Burundi beats of Adam and the Ants, you know, the stuff that they were doing. And a couple of people, I mean, Joni Mitchell had used those beats as well, actually, a little earlier. But it was a sort of slightly African feel to the rhythm that I wanted to get. And so I think it is that sort of the mixture of electronic synths and the African feel in the drums or the shuffle thing. Someone once said Dancehall Days was the first hip-hop record, you know, which I thought was quite funny. But
just to interrupt you there, so we can thank your student for not pitching up, for creating such beautiful music and for you putting you guys on the map. Did you ever thank that student?
I never did. No, I didn't realize what was happening with me. but it's fortunate that he didn't show up, or she. Yep. I can't remember whether it was a he or a she. Yeah.
And Everyone Have Fun Tonight.
Everyone Have Fun Tonight was, I guess we'd had the hit with Dancehall Days. There's then, you know, the follow up hit, and we managed to avoid that by working on the movie soundtrack to Live and Die in LA. So that sort of kicked the problem of having a hit single into touch for a while. But eventually it came back. So, Nick and I used to meet up and play each other ideas. And one day he played me this idea that was essentially the embryonic Everybody Have Fun Tonight sort of idea. Yep. And I loved it, much to his surprise, because he thought I'd find it too cheesy, you know. But I worked on it and sort of came back to him with a sort of version of the song that was quite slow and a bit like Hey Jude by the Beatles, you know, Beatles once again. Yeah. And, you know, but anyway, we demoed it, and there was a sort of buzz about that song. But when we worked with our producer, Peter Wolf, he was kind of like, this has got to be a up-tempo song, party song, everybody have fun tonight.
Yeah.
And I was like, no, you don't get it. It's meant to be sort of ironic, but he was insistent, and so he, you know, in the studio we sort of created a song together. So Peter was very important in the way that the song ended up.
Tell me now, who, besides the Beatles and those artists you mentioned, who were you listening to in the 80s, and who of the current batch of artists, if any, are you currently listening to?
In the 80s, there were bands I was listening to. I mean, I was listening to a lot of classical music, actually, in a slightly naughty boy kind of way, because I should have been listening to 80s music and taking in what was new, you know. But the bands I liked, I loved the Blue Nile. I loved a band called the Concert Angels. I liked Talk Talk. Tears for Fears I liked as well, though, who Chris Hughes was working with, and one of the reasons we wanted to work with Chris was because of his work with Tears for Fears, you know. So I think it was slightly more, if you like, I think a lot of the bands in the 80s were influenced by progressive rock, in a sense, but they were kind of repressing all of that influence in trying to write pop songs.
Yeah.
And and trying to take on the legacy of punk, you know, which was like to be brief and to the point, you know. But I always detected in the Blue Nile, Concert Angels, Susie and the Banshees was another one, you know, that they had this feel for 70s music and that sort of like leaked into what they were doing. So I kind of like that about 80s bands, you know. The Tubes was another 80s band I really loved. So. And in terms of bands now, I guess I'm not super cognizant of what's going on. But one thing that I did come across recently that I love is an album by an artist called Floating Points.
Okay.
Working with Sarah Sanders and the London Symphony Orchestra, I think. And that album to me is a total masterpiece, like really wonderful. And that came out in 2020, I think. So, and he also produced an album called Eliana or Eliane. Eliane, I can never pronounce it. And that came out in maybe 2016. And that too, I think, is a fantastic album. So Floating Points, I'm a huge fan.
There was a period of time that you guys were not touring or performing together.
Mm.
Tell us, what were you up to during that period of time?
Mm. So that was the 90s, I guess, really, because the Wang Chung stopped in like 1990, really, you know. So during that time, I did a bit of producing work with Chris Hughes. We produced a band called The Definition of Sound together.
Okay.
Also worked with a band called Gene together as well. I also produced a band called Arcana for Nick. When Nick stopped sort of being an artist in a way and started working for record labels. And so one of his bands was Arcana. So I did an album with them. And I also did an album with Tony Banks, who's the keyboard player in Genesis. And Tony was doing a solo album, and he needed a singer and someone to help him with the lyrics. So I stepped into that breach, and yeah, that was a lovely time, actually. That's about 95, 96. And we made an album. He wanted to give it. He didn't want to call it a Tony Banks album because he thought that had a stigma about it. Mm-hmm. So he called it Strictly Inc. And yeah, some people who are deep into Genesis consider Strictly Inc. a sort of covert Genesis album, really, you know. So, and it does. It sort of refers back to almost the sort of Peter Gabriel years of Genesis, you know. So
you and Nick were still in contact during that time. You were still in each other's orbits. You were still chatting and that kind of stuff. And what inspired you guys to reform Wang Chung and just have fun again?
Yeah, well, I think it just enough water passed under the bridge for us to want to do that. There were some business deals around 2006-07 that meant that we saw a lot more of each other. And I think there was a general sense that there was a sort of warmth towards Wang Chung, if you like, you know, reforming and doing something new would be, well received, you know. Also, I had written quite a lot of songs. Nick had a few songs as well, and we produced this album called Taser Up that came out in around about 2012, I think. So it was good. Us getting back together was a fertile thing. And then we've done these sort of summer tours in the States. We did come to South Africa. That was probably back in 2017, something like that.
Okay.
And we did a few sort of festival gigs, which was really fun. It was fascinating to come to your country and see, well, just to see it, because it's so beautiful. You know, the geography, the topography of it is incredible, you know.
So tell me more about your South African trip. You've mentioned you traveled throughout the country pre-coming to it. What was your perception of it? Post-coming to it, were those perceptions met or distinguished by your actually being here?
Yeah.
Just your whole interpretation of the country and the people.
Interesting question. I guess I didn't really have a particular preconceptions about it, you know. Coming to the country, I guess I did feel the sort of, like in Johannesburg, I felt the sort of edginess of some areas of the city and stuff. We were right on the Indian Ocean. I can't remember.
Durban.
Durban, yes. Durban. That was very beautiful, I thought. And we also stayed in Cape Town for a while and drove out. I remember going up into the sort of wine district and sort of hanging out there, you know. But I get, you know, I guess maybe like all big cities, there's some beautiful parts, but there's a lot of poverty, you know.
Yeah.
And I guess the legacy of all of the problems of South Africa, I was felt quite sensitive to that, actually, you know. So, it was a sort of mixed feelings, you know. But I did love the people. I bought a great guitar there that was made out of an oil can.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
And so it was some really lovely memories of it as well. Yeah.
So there's been lots of nostalgia over the last few years, like these rewind festivals where all these bands come together and have like an 80s fun get together, 80s and 90s. What are your thoughts, or why do you think somehow, not more, but there's something around the music from the 80s and early 90s that has this warmth and nostalgia that people want to keep going back to and connecting with? Why do you think that is?
I think the music is, generally speaking, I mean, is generally speaking very positive. You know, that sort of, especially that sort of American chart music, had just a very positive feel in the energy of the music. You know, it's not to do with the lyrics so much, you know, which could be quite dark on occasions, you know. But the artists who dominated the 80s, I think, were producing, it was like an up kind of time, really. Yeah. You know, I mean, the 80s was full of problems. I mean, maybe not quite as desperate problems as the ones we face these days, you know. But nevertheless, I remember, you know, when Ronald Reagan was in power and stuff, it all felt pretty dystopian. And, you know, there were the wars going on as there are now, you know, but they didn't feel quite so volatile and dangerous as they do now, you know. And I think, I think technology was pushing music forward as well in a really interesting way. And I think music was culturally still very central in people's lives. You know, MTV was a really big thing in people's lives. And whereas now I find music is sort of one of many possible forms of entertainment and possibly marginalized, you know, as a sort of accompaniment to movies and computer games and even social media. And, you know, music's sort of a backdrop for it, but it's not right in the foreground. And I think I think particularly the 60s and 70s, but even still in the 80s, music was foreground and very much about who you were. You know, your identity was very bound up with the sort of music you listened to. So, and that's true to a certain extent now, but again, not quite as powerful it was back then.
And what's interesting, carry on.
No, I was just going to say that positive thing, I think, was just somehow in the music. I don't know quite why, but it was there in distinction to what happened in the 90s and later on.
Yeah. What's interesting is you mention all this, and I'm very much, I love my CDs. I still buy my CDs. I'm still opening that book. When you mentioned that deluxe, I was like, I'm adding it to my list. It's going to be there. It was vinyl, cassette, CDs. Those are making a comeback. In fact, last year, for the first time in 21 years, I'm not sure if you know this, CDs increase their sales. For the first time in 21 years, cassettes are making a comeback, vinyls are making a comeback, but it's all these digital platforms. Tell me, what are your thoughts on how people are now consuming and listening to and engaging and interacting with music compared to when you were releasing music in the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, well, I think this whole thing about the physical object that you play your music from, you know, is very important, you know, and the lack of that with streaming, I think, is a massive lack, you know, cumulatively, you know. So I buy a lot of vinyl now. I've got a lovely record deck here and, you know, good sound system. Vinyl is a great way to listen, I think, because it does make you sort of sit down and listen. There's something about the format and the sound of it as well. And CDs, I'm similar to you. I started buying CDs again. And I just like having the objects, you know, and to be able to sort of read the sleeve notes and all of that stuff. And my oldest son, Harry, was actually talking to me about streaming recently. And he said, the problem with streaming is there's always something else. You know, when you're listening, you're sort of thinking about what shall I play next, you know, because the access is infinite, you know. Whereas when you put on a CD and even more with a piece of vinyl, you're not thinking about that. You're listening to what you're listening to, you know. So, I think these physical formats will continue to make a comeback. And, you know, the streaming services are great, as I say, for access. You know, you kind of put a song in your head and you just want to hear it again. There it is, right at the click of a button. But the lack of context for it, I think that's what it is, is problematic long term. Yeah. And people who are really into music will always go to physical formats, I think.
And what's interesting, because I've got my Spotify account because I teach spinning classes and I create playlists for that. But like I said, I still buy my CDs. But every now and then I go back into that Spotify playlist that I created maybe a year or 2 years ago. Mm. I'm like, one of the songs are gone. That song's no longer there. You know, they've removed the song. Yeah. Whereas if I've got the CD, it's ever present. It's always in my hand. I will never not have that song. in my hand, it will not be in the cloud somewhere for someone to delete or remove away from.
Exactly right, yeah. And inevitably, these companies will come and go. You know, it's like, you know, they're around now, but will Spotify be around in 5 years? Probably not.
Yeah.
So, it's, you know, something else might be, that company might buy up all of the data from Spotify and regenerate it all, or it may not, you know. So I think it is, it's very ephemeral in every sense, you know. And it's not, you know, I think the guy who runs Spotify said something about, you know, like, you know, Spotify's not about music, it's about subscriptions, you know, and I think that sort of sums it all up, really.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's really, the minute you said that, my head tilted to the side for those
listeners. Yeah.
Like, really? But,
It's enough to make you want to cancel your subscription immediately. That's
You were speaking of this 40th anniversary album or edition. So are there going to be any new songs and new tracks there, or just remixes and updates of the old songs?
Well, there's no new songs in the sense of from now, but there's new songs. There's unreleased stuff on the album. So songs that have, I mean, there's been some Wang Chung fans, you know, Uber fans who've been pushing around various different you know, outtakes and live stuff. But this will be, we're working with a guy called Vinny Vera in New York. And Vinny is the most meticulous encyclopedic mind you'll ever come across, and absolutely loves kind of collating all of these sort of things that even I'd forgotten that we did. In fact, he sent me some lyrics that he tried to transcribe from a song that I just couldn't remember. So he had to send me the song, and I listened to it this morning. And there's some really rare stuff going to come out on it.
I'm looking forward to it. And when is that coming out?
Well, we plan to have something when we're touring in August in the States, because we plan to tour in the States this August. But I think the official release will probably be September, early September, possibly mid-September.
Cool. I'm looking forward to seeing that. And any plans to come back to South Africa to perform again?
Well, I'd love to. I mean, there are no concrete plans, but it would be great to come back and do some more stuff.
So I will be there in the wings, there, and we'll go for coffee, and we'll go for drinks. I'm going to put you on the spot right now. I get my little evil laugh and little evil grin when I do this.
Your
top five favorite songs by other artists. Top of mind now, come to mind. What are your top five favorite songs by other artists?
Okay. Hey Jude by the Beatles.
Okay.
Purple Rain by Prince.
Okay.
Five songs. You Keep Me Hanging On by The Supremes.
Okay.
All in the pop world, we can't sort of stray off into jazz.
Anything, anything.
Yeah, really. So I would say Lulu's Back in Town by Thelonious Monk.
Okay.
His version of that, yeah. What should we end up with? Voodoo Child by Jimi Hendrix.
Wow, such an eclectic mix. I'm going to add all of them. Some of them already, most of them already, I've got them, but a couple of those I'm going to check out. To finish off, last question. We wish for those guys who are watching, listening. Nick was unfortunately not well today. He could not join us. He's got a bit of COVID. So we send him well wishes and blessings and all those lovely kind of things. And next time we'll be speaking to the two of you. But as a last message to our listening and viewing audience, what would that last message be?
Stay safe is for sure. You know, poor Nick, he's managed to avoid COVID all these years, isn't it? It's been with us, but now has it. But he'll be okay, I'm sure. You know. My message to all you guys, listen to lots of music and let it really touch your soul, and love one another.
Ah, brilliant. I love that. So we have been speaking to Mr. Jack Hughes from Wang Chung. This is Celeb Savant Barrett signing out. Yeah.